So I'm going to talk tonight just a little bit about the divine office. You've been singing lauds in the morning and compline at night, and we'll have one vespers on Friday afternoon. But the question comes up, what is it and why do you do it and how do you do it? It's often said that the divine office constitutes the sanctification of time. And that notion of sanctification of time is I think, important because, first of all, it's based upon the natural phenomena of time. That is to say, the seasons, the month, the week, the day, the hour. So, for instance, the seasons. The seasons are based upon the winter solstice, the summer solstice, the vernal equinox, the autumnal equinox. Those are parts of the natural phenomenon that many cultures recognize. For the sanctification of time, some of the principal feasts of the year are placed upon those points of the calendar. So Christmas, for instance, comes approximately at the winter solstice, the point at which light is the shortest and the point at which it then begins to increase. And that is then complemented by the vernal equinox, the Feast of the Annunciation. 9 months before Christmas, the Annunciation takes place. Likewise, coming up, tomorrow, the Feast of St. John the Baptist at the summer solstice. On the ground that John the Baptist said, he must increase and I must decrease. And so just as the light increases from the time of Christmas, so the light begins to decrease at the time of the birth of St. John the Baptist. It's not very often recognized, but there is a fourth point in the calendar that is celebrated, at least in the Eastern Church, and that is the Annunciation of, guess who? John the Baptist, 9 months before June 24th at the autumnal equinox. So there is a kind of a seasonal sort of points of sacred events that observe those points of the time. Likewise, the month is a time that is determined essentially by the moon, and that's why we say month. It has to do, it's etymologically connected with the moon, and how the month is observed is an interesting phenomenon, and that is in the Roman calendar you start counting the new month 8 days before the first day of the month. So that gives you something like the 24th or the 25th of the month as the most important day. And then you see Christmas, say John the Baptist, Annunciation. Those days are then on that key day of the month. But what's not has been observed so much is that, in fact, feasts of apostles fall on those 25th or 4th day of the month. At least in the old calendar, before people thought it was proper to move apostles around. And those, for instance, the conversion of St. Paul, January 25th, St. Matthias, February 24th. March 25th is already taken. April 25th, St. Mark. Peter and Paul, June 25th, St. James, July 25th, and so forth. So that there is just because just as there are 12 apostles, more or less, there are 12 months to observe them by. The week also is, I suppose, that's not as strongly a natural phenomenon, except that it is the division of the month into four, just as the year is divided into four by the solstices and the equinoxes. So the month then is divided into four, making the weeks. And the week is particularly important in that in the divine office, the Psalter is distributed over the week in the old office. And that means that essentially you say the entire psalm, the 150 psalms, in the course of the week. And they are distributed, the first psalm through 108 at Matins, and 109 through 147 at Vespers, with some others being sort of taken out of those cycles for the other hours. But between those two main hours, you have principally the cycle of the psalms. Likewise, the hymns for Vespers observe the days of creation. So there is, in fact, another semi-natural phenomenon the week of creation then is a precedent for the observance of the week, but the hymns for the days of the Vespers for the weekdays, including Sunday, sometimes attributed to St. Gregory, speak of, first of all, on Sunday, the creation of light, on Monday, the creation of the heavens, Tuesday, the creation of land and plants, Wednesday, the creation of heavenly bodies, Thursday, birds and fishes, Friday, animals and man, and then on Saturday, rest. And so the Saturday hymn then is a hymn to the Trinity. So there is then, there are many, many wonderful things that help to observe the course of the week. The day also is observed, and the principal points of articulation of the day are obviously sunrise and sunset. And that then gives us the point of Lauds and Vespers. And then also, of course, in the middle of the night, Matins. And then the Roman hours, dividing the day in the day, daylight hours by four again, gives you prime, terce, sext, and nome. So the fourfold division of these times seems to be applied to both the year and the month and the day. Now, it's interesting that in the old rite, there is a kind of integration of the day by the gospel said at the Mass, so that at Matins, you will hear a sermon on that gospel. At Lauds, you will have an antiphon to the Benedictus that will recall that story of the gospel. At Vespers, again, an antiphon to the Magnificat, and you will then have, by that time, heard the gospel at the Mass. In fact, if you just hear the antiphon to the Magnificat, sometimes all you get is something like, "And they lived happily ever after." It's just the very end of the story, and you have to really know that gospel of the day to make sense of it. Likewise, the collect said at Mass is said at the hours of the office as well. So those things integrate the day through the liturgy. Now, the office itself is constituted principally by that distribution of the Psalms through the week. And the Psalms, so the Psalms take a special place in the office, and there are many things about them that give special meaning to the offices. The Psalm 109, Dixit Dominus, the Lord said to my Lord, sit thou at my right hand. You have, in fact, a summary of that, its text, on this handout. Psalm 109 is the psalm for, is the first psalm of the cycle of psalms for Vespers. It's the first psalm of Sunday Vespers. And the interesting thing is that Sunday Vespers, then, Psalms 109, 10, 11, 12, and 13, form the paradigm for all male saints' feast days. So that, with the exception of the final psalm, 113, anybody who's sung Vespers knows how long it is, and sometimes that's replaced by Psalm 116, the shortest of all the psalms. The nice thing is that if you celebrate a Saints' Day, you get a little vacation from the long psalm. But the psalms themselves, then, are an important part of the musical shape of the liturgy. Because the psalms themselves have a characteristic that's called parallelismus membrorum. That is to say, the poetry of the psalm consists not of meter or rhyme, but rather of a bipartite verse structure that consists of a poetic complement, one half to the other. So, the Lord said to my Lord, sit thou at my right hand. Those are two complete sentences, but they're complementary. And because of that, then, you have the typical way in which you would chant a psalm that would articulate that structure. The psalm tone goes to a middle cadence. Dixit Dominus Domino meo, sede a dextris mei. So that bipartite structure, then, in fact, engenders the kind of structure that you have in the psalm tone, the melody for the psalm itself. And so Psalm 109, then, is going to appear quite a few times during the year, more than just once a week. Many saints' days will occur. And so you would think this would get wearisome after a while. But the fact it doesn't is conditioned by the fact that the antiphons change. So the function of the antiphon, then, is to complement the neutral chanting of the song. You would chant, Dixit Dominus Domino Meo, sede a dextris meis, donec bonam inimicos tuos, scabellum pedum tuorum, virgam virtutis tuae mitetso, etc. It isn't a kind of melody that you would write home about. But you see, it's a neutral melody that allows you to chant the whole psalm text without being held up, but gives it an elevated tone of voice and articulates its bipartite structure. But what's missing is anything very interesting melodically. And so the answer to that is the antiphon. The antiphon, then, is sung before and after the chanting of the psalm, and that antiphon bears enough melodic interest to complement and to aid in making the chanting of the psalm be interesting. Thus, Dixit Dominus Domino meo, sede a dextris meis. Then you start chanting the psalm. Dixit Dominus Domino meo, Sedeo dextris meis. And you sing all the verses, including the doxology. And then you have time to sing the antiphon. Dixit Dominus Domino meo, Sedeo dextris meis. Well, that's only the start. Because if you look at your handout, you see there are just some of the antiphons that are assigned to Psalm 109. So for the normal Sunday, the first verse of the psalm, which more or less gives the message that the whole psalm is the significance of this chanting on Sundays. For Feasts of the Apostles, however, verse 5 is given in part. The Lord has sworn and he will not repent. Thou art a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. Melchizedek, as you probably know, was an Old Testament priest who offered a sacrifice of bread and wine for Abraham. And he's then taken to be a type of Christ, but Christ as a priest who also offered a sacrifice of bread and wine. But also then, apostles are other Christs. And so their feast days are ornamented by having that verse tell you about the context of that psalm. And what it does is not only just give you a theme for the psalm, but it in fact influences the way you'll sing that psalm itself. Because that antiphon is in a different mode. Iuhut avis Dominus et non penitebiteum tu es sacerdos in aeternum. Dixit Dominus Domino meo, sedea dextris mei. See, that's a different melody than you would sing on the Sunday for the same song. And each of these antiphons then will have the same effect, be in a different mode and give a slightly different context. So, for instance, on Christmas, the antiphon is in fact the fourth psalm, the fourth verse of Psalm 109. Tecum principium, with thee is the principality in the day of thy strength, in the brightness of the saints, from the womb before the day star I begot thee. This is a text that is often sung in the liturgy at Christmas, and because it speaks of the eternal begetting of the Father, of the Son from the Father. And the themes of Christmas, it's quite interesting, the themes of the Mass propers on the Midnight Mass are all that, the eternal begetting of the Son from the Father. The Mass and the day are all about the earthly birth in Bethlehem. And yet, both of those Masses is the full story, because along with the Mass propers that deal with the eternal beginning of the Son on Christmas Eve is the Gospel about Caesar Augustus calling for a tax and Mary and Joseph going to Bethlehem. And on the Mass in the day, where the Mass propers give the story of the birth in Bethlehem, the Gospel of the day is the beginning of the Gospel of St. John. In the beginning was the Word, and so there again, something about the eternal begetting of the Son from the Father. So the Vespers antiphon for Christmas reminds one of that theme, that the Messiah, who's, and this is taken to be a messianic psalm as a whole, the Messiah who is spoken of in this psalm is in fact begotten of the Father from all ages. For Epiphany, that same theme is the basis for the antiphon, but the text is rewritten to suit the theme of the Epiphany. So the text, begotten before the day star and before all ages, the Lord our Savior is today made manifest to the world. So that's a kind of paraphrase or addition of text to the psalm text for the sake of characterizing the Epiphany. Another way in which those antiphons are derived is that the story of the day or of the saint can give rise to a whole set of antiphons. So on Easter Sunday, it's a little bit of a surprise to see that antiphon on Easter Sunday, because you would expect something so essential about the resurrection theologically. But instead what you get is, on this one, the angel of the Lord descended from heaven and going up rolled back the stone and sat upon it. And then you sing Psalm 109. And the reason for that is that the next psalm has the next part of the story of the women, finding the tomb empty. And the whole story then is told in the sequence of the five antiphons to the five psalms which are proper to the day. So it's then you find that a number of saints' days will also have the same kind of story that comes from the story of the saint's life. For the dedication of the church, a different psalm is drawn upon for the antiphon. Psalm 92, "Thy house, O Lord," denotes holiness unto all ages. And then you sing that same Dixit Dominus psalm, and the theme then is clearly the theme of the house of the Lord. Or for the feast of St. John the Baptist, "He shall go before him in the spirit and strength of Elias to prepare a perfect people for the Lord," paraphrasing the Gospel of St. Luke. So there, a gospel text that pertains to the day will frame the antiphon, frame the psalm with the antiphon. For the first Sunday of Advent, Advent being a time when you love to hear the prophets, this antiphon for this psalm is from Zechariah. "Behold, the Lord shall come and all his saints with him, and there shall be on that day a great light." And that's a wonderful Advent theme, and that then frames the psalm for that time. For a feast of the Blessed Virgin, for a modern mentality, it's something a little bit surprising. But in fact, many of the antiphons are drawn from the Song of Songs. So this one for Psalm 109, "When the king was reclining, my spikenard, my perfume, yielded an odor of sweetness." That simply goes back to the interpretation of the Song of Songs. And the Middle Ages and the tradition allowed the interpretation, allowed many interpretations of the same text, a literal interpretation and then other figurative interpretations. And perhaps the most fundamental one for the Song of Songs is that this poem that expresses in some sense a human kind of love is in fact an expression of the love of God for his people. But in the Middle Ages, it was also, and it wasn't seen as any contradiction, that it could also express the love of us, of the Blessed Virgin. That is, our love for the Blessed Virgin. And so, therefore, the Psalm 109 on the Feast of the Blessed Virgin gets that antiphon. For the Feast of St. Michael the Archangel, from the book of the Apocalypse, where angels are prominent. "An angel stood near the altar of the temple, holding a golden censer in his hand." And then Psalm 109. So there you see a range of possible themes that determine a difference in the mode of the chanting of the psalm, that mean that that psalm is subject to considerable variety, even though the text of the psalm remains the same. I've often thought that these antiphons, the way they frame the psalm, must have been the model for the mysteries of the rosary. That, in fact, the the rosary is the poor man's psalter. It has 150 decades. It used to have 150 decades until Pope John Paul II ruined the symbolism. Not to say that he wasn't right to add the mysteries of the illumination, the luminous mysteries. The point is only that the rosary had 150 Hail Marys because the Psalms were 150. And so then, if you think about it, the mysteries of the rosary have a similar function to each decade of the rosary, that that each mystery then gives a different theme to the saying of the 10 Hail Marys. Hymns also can give a variety to the singing of Vespers, and there are many wonderful hymns in the Roman office. Likewise, the Magnificat is another fixed text. Oh, one thing I forgot, and that is, so you have for male saints the sequence of Psalm 109, 10, 11, 12, and either 113 or 16. For female saints, they follow the pattern of Feasts of the Blessed Virgin, which in fact then has Psalm 109, 112, 121, Laetatis sum, I rejoiced when they said to me, and I will go into the house of the Lord. Psalm 126, Nisi Dominus, unless the Lord build this house, in vain they build the house. And then Lauda Jerusalem, praise Jerusalem. So interestingly, for the Feasts of the Blessed Virgin, the themes of the Psalms themselves have to do with a house and with the city, Jerusalem, both dwelling places. I think because the Blessed Virgin herself was the dwelling place of the Lord. And so that is then reflected by the Psalms that are chosen for her, and then female saints get that same set of Psalms. So those are the Psalms that you'll find, for instance, in the Monteverdi Vespers, because that is the Vespers of the Blessed Virgin. So the Magnificat, then, is a fixed text. It is always the text that is sung at the Gospel Canticle in the Office of Vespers. And for that reason, then, it needs a greater cycle of antiphons. And so there are changing antiphons for every Sunday of the year. Likewise, so that the Magnificat is almost, you might say, ordinary for the office, just as the Kyrie and Gloria are ordinary for the Mass, and they have given rise to the same kinds of serious compositions. So just as we get compositions of intense polyphonic music for the ordinary, the Mass, Kyrie, Gloria, Credo, etc., so we get extensive sets of polyphonic Magnificats. For example, the Monteverdi Vespers itself has two different Magnificats. And Orlando di Lasso composed more Magnificats than he did polyphonic Masses. He composed something like well over 100 Magnificats, only about 60 Masses. He was just an idler. Vespers, it's not often realized that the Vespers should end with the Marian Antiphon, Salve Regina. The rubric in the breviary says, it says it in a funny way, if you go down from the choir at the end of Vespers, then you must sing the Salve Regina. What that means is, if you don't sing Compline immediately, then you sing the Salve Regina. And I think that that derives from the fact that at some point, very often they made a procession to a Marian shrine or a Marian chapel or a Marian altar of some kind, singing the Salve Regina, because the Salve Regina, as you sing it at Vespers, has the form of a procession. The form of a procession is you have a chant to sing on the way, you have something to sing when you get there, and you have a collect, which concludes the procession. And so the chant on the way is the Salve Regina, the something to sing when you get there is the versicle and response, and then the collect is the prayer that you say. And if you look at the medieval practice of processions, you see that very typically on the first Vespers of a saint's day who had an altar in a church. If there's an altar in the church, on his first Vespers, you make a procession to that altar. And it shows exactly that same form, a chant to be sung on the way, something to sing when you get there, and then a collect. That's incidentally, that doesn't pertain to the divine office, but incidentally, that is a pattern then that you can see in the structure of the Mass itself. The Mass has two principal parts, the liturgy of the Word and the liturgy of the Sacrament. But it is surrounded by elaborate processional activity. That is to say, the introit procession, something to sing while the priest enters into the church and incenses the altar, and then something to sing when you get there, the Kyrie and the Gloria, and then a collect, which concludes that processional activity, after which then everyone sits down and hears the lessons. The offertory then serves as another procession like that, and it's concluded by a collect, the prayer over the offerings, as we say, or as some say, the prayer over the gifts. I've always thought that that was a little presumptuous to think that what we brought were something that was needed by the Lord, but rather they're better described as offerings, it seems to me. But in any case, then, the communion is the same. You have an antiphon that is sung during the procession of the communion, and I suppose what is sung is inverted a little bit, so the Agnus Dei has that function, and then there's the post-communion, which concludes that rite. So on that ground, I have suggested that the term opening prayer of the Mass is a misnomer, that it's actually the closing prayer of the entrance rite. And to call it the opening prayer of the Mass is to dismiss the Kyrie and the Gloria and the introit as incidental. And I would suggest that they are not quite that. Now, the office, the divine office, I'm speaking essentially about the old office, the office before the Second Vatican Council. There are several reasons for doing that. One is that it is the paradigm from which the new office, the Liturgy of the Hours, was constructed, but its form is clearer and its structure is clearer. Another is that it is an unmistakably sung office. In spite of the fact that in recent memory, priests almost entirely spoke their office, their breviary, quietly, the form of that office retains the form of a sung office. and the sometime in the 12th or 13th centuries, with the mendicants who had to travel more than they were than previous religious were doing, they were not always able to attend the community sum offices, and so they created the breviary so they could take it with them and say it when they couldn't be at the sum office. And it was a gradual devolution, I would say, of the sum office that turned it into the priest's obligation to speak the breviary every day. But even there are some differences. I remember the biography of Cardinal Bellarmine, who, when he was a cardinal, had many appointments. He had to keep office hours, and he would have appointments, and that at a certain point in the appointment, he would say, "We have to break off our appointment now because it's time for me to say my office." In other words, it's time to say terce or sext or none or vespers. And what that says is he observed the points of the day as the sanctification of time indicates one should. I was told by a very busy priest who said, actually, the best thing to do is to say the whole office the first thing in the morning and get it out of the way. Well, there may have been some efficiency to that, but it doesn't really quite fulfill the needs of the sanctification of time then. So the office is then a sung phenomenon, and that's why I'm more interested in looking at the old office, because it remains in form a sung form. The Liturgy of the Hours was really constructed for priests to say privately and took no account of the needs of singing. And there are several details about that office that suggest that the people who put it together had no idea that it would ever be sung. And the fact is, it has taken 40 years for them to produce the first book of singing of the new Liturgy of the Hours. There is now, as of 2009, an Antiphonale Romanum for only Vespers of Sundays and Feasts, not of the weekdays and not anything but Vespers. And it is a book of some 700 or 800 pages. One can imagine that if ever, now let's see, let's do the arithmetic, it's going to take them about 300 years to issue the entire set of books that will be needed to sing the Liturgy of the Hours. And at that point, you'll have a library that you'll have to use to do it. So the other reason for looking at the old office is Summum Pontificum. Benedict, it's something that probably has escaped most people's attention, but Benedict also said, priests may freely say the old office. They may say the old breviary or the new Liturgy of the Hours. And so if you celebrate a Vespers and your pastor is asked to officiate at it, you can say, this now does fulfill your canonical obligation to the office. There was some question before Summum Pontificum that it would. But now, just to say something about the singing of the office. The office is centrally the chanting of the Psalms, complemented by a hymn, by a Magnificat in the case of Vespers. It's sung antiphonally, and the antiphonal singing is something quite interesting. Because if you sing the entire office, as you would in, say, a Benedictine monastery, it would take you 6 or 8 hours of singing. And I was told once by an old monk who said, novices tend to lose their voice by the third week because they're enthusiastic about singing, but it's too much singing. And so, and then he said, and then they have to learn to modulate the way they sing, so they sing freely enough that they don't tire their voices too much. But there is something about the way the office is arranged that also helps that, and that is the choir sits in choir stalls facing each other, and they alternate singing the successive verses of the song, so that it's antiphonal singing. One choir sings one verse, the next choir sings the next verse. And there is a practical a function of that. It saves the voice. But there's also a spiritual function of it. First of all, it's taken to be, to have a precedent in the seraphim who cried out each to the other before the face of God, holy, holy, holy. And so that's a powerful precedent for the office. But there's also the notion that each side of the choir ministers to the other, so that when you don't have to sing the verse, you can listen and take heart to the verse that you're being sung to. That is, that this other side is singing for you. So that antiphonal singing then, it gives, in fact, gives the Vespers a certain form and shape and a sense of ceremony. There are other ceremonies that are included with the Vespers, such as, for instance, particularly in a Benedictine form, you stand and sit frequently, and you bow for the Gloria Patri. In the Roman form, you bow for the Gloria Patri, but I've always thought the Roman form was inferior because you're sitting down and all you do is hunch down. It doesn't quite have the same expressive effect as a real bow standing. It happens that my choir that sings Vespers every Sunday stands for the Gloria Patri and bows. And this has a rather funny history because one of our members had been a former Dominican nun, and she insisted we had to do it that way because that's the way they did it. And it struck me that it was actually more a more expressive gesture than the other, and so we did it. And that's how liturgical things get started, I think. Now, the singing of Vespers for your own practice. I have to say that it was 1975 that we started to sing Vespers. It's about 6 or 8 of my choir. The choir is on the biggest feast days, maybe 25 or 30, and on a normal Sunday about 15, say. 6 or 8 people will sing Vespers also. And they're not the most skilled singers, in fact. They're the ones who want to come back and have more church. And so it takes a while for you to learn how to do it. But in fact, after 35 years, they've become proficient at it. And it was only within the last 5 or 6 years that it occurred to me that we ought to try some polyphonic music. That is to say, the simple falso bordone, that is the tradition of chanting the psalms in polyphonic music, harmonization of the psalm tone, essentially. And so it was like pulling teeth to get them to figure out how you alternate the chant with the falso bordone. But once that was settled, they took on to it very well. And so we sing every other psalm to a falso bordone. And then you can sing polyphonic hymns, polyphonic magnificats, any number of things. It turned out that sometime in the 80s, Pope John Paul II declared a Marian year. And I said, we've got to do something to observe that Marian year. And as soon as I thought of it, I was just at the time studying the English medieval Sarum Rite and recalled that that there was this practice of the procession after Vespers. So I thought, let's, for the Marian year, have a procession after Vespers. Well, there's a funny thing about that procession, because this was in a chapel that was fairly modern in design, and it had a Marian picture, which was a mosaic, that was done by a trendy local artist, and it had a kind of halo that was made up of rays in this mosaic. Well, rays in a mosaic made out of kind of rough stone don't always look like light, and they looked a little bit more like feathers. And so she, poor thing, acquired the nickname of Our Lady of the War Bonnet. And, and I said, we can't make a procession to Our Lady of the War Bonnet. And my colleague said, just do it. And so we just did it. And the interesting thing that happened was she lost the nickname, and we now take her to be a proper representation of the Blessed Virgin, limitations notwithstanding. So that was a... and, of course, the next thing was, after the Marian year was over, we said, we can't stop now, so we still do it. It's a beautiful part of our Vespers, in fact. So you can sing Vespers. You can start easily, simply. We had another sort of curious instance that caused us to do it in a particular way, and that was one of the original members who was singing the Vespers was a mathematician, and my only surmise is that his brain was wired differently than the rest of us, because as soon as he started to sing with men and women, he tried to sing the average between the two pitches. And so he would sing at approximately a fairly rough tritone. And so my solution was to simply divide the men and the women and have him sing with the men. And as soon as we did that, he sang fine. And that then created another tradition, and that is that we divided men and women. And it has the beautiful benefit that the unison singing of both men and women is just more beautiful than the mixed singing of men and women together. And so we sing the antiphons and the hymns and those things. Well, the hymns we sing in alternation also. We sing the antiphons and some of the other things together as mixed, but then the psalms themselves are sung in alternation, men and women on opposite sides of the church singing in unison. That suggests another aesthetic consideration, and that is that when you sing the harmonized psalm tones, the falso bordone, the sort of quasi-polyphonic setting of the chant verses, and when you alternate them with plain song, one verse is in chant, the next is in polyphonic music, and you'll hear that in the Vespers on Friday. This was a remark that came from someone who observed the Vespers. They said, well, the chant makes the polyphony sound so luxurious, and the polyphony makes the chant sound so pure. So the contrast between those two things is something really very beautiful and is a valuable part of the Vespers. It's the entire Vespers can be sung in that kind of alternation, because just like the Psalms, which are divided into separate verses, so the Magnificat, so the hymns into stanzas, they fall nicely into patterns that can be alternated. An advantage of doing Vespers is, with forgiveness from our clerical friends, we don't need a priest to sing Vespers. So that if as one of my former students, when she moved away and went to another university, found that the Newman Center wasn't interested at all in having a chant mass, she started a Vespers group. And she's now on leave for a year, and the people who are in the Vespers group are continuing to sing Vespers while she's gone, even. So that's something that you can do. There's a way to help out the Vespers, and that is to link it with benediction. Benediction itself is a little bit short just to have by itself. But Vespers isn't that long. It's generally about a half an hour. So if you put Vespers and benediction together, you have a very wonderful complement between two services. And you also have, I think, a greater interest in coming to the Vespers. It's true that in Europe and by the tradition, Vespers was attended often by the laity. It's not so much so in anymore, but it's something that can be cultivated. Likewise, Vespers can be done for festive occasions. I know a number of choirs that will have a Vespers on their dedication of their church feast day. Just a one-time Vespers. They prepare some fancy music, and it's a very festive occasion, and it's very well liked. You can, in fact, use any number of kinds of polyphony. There is, for example, the 1610 Vespers of Monteverdi. Hardly anybody can manage that, but if you could, it would be a splendid Marian Vespers. It happens that this is the 400th anniversary of the 1610 Vespers, and it's receiving a lot of performances in concert, but I don't know that it has received any liturgical performances. But if that's too steep a hill to climb, there are other Monteverdi Vespers. There are the 1640 and 1650 collections of Vespers music that were Venetian Vespers music that are a little bit more feasible. And a festive Vespers made of those pieces would be splendid. They take a continuo and two violins and then a choir. And there are some absolutely spectacular pieces in those collections. Vespers also includes some ceremonies. I mentioned the fact that you incense the altar at the Magnificat. One has to think for a moment, why would you do that? Because in the Mass, the incensing of the altar is some kind of preparation for its being used as the focal point of the sacrifice of the Mass. But also one should recall that the Gospel is incensed. And so the Magnificat is the Gospel canticle. And this, I think, just simply recalls the incensing at the Mass and adds a certain amount of ceremony to the Vespers itself. There is yet one other kind of divine office, and that is the little office of the Blessed Virgin. The little office is what you find in most books of ours from the Middle Ages. The laity often said the little office. There is this notion that in the Middle Ages the laity couldn't understand Latin. Well, it was in fact the laity who were illiterate who could not understand, and there were many, but who could not understand Latin. They could not read any languages. But the aristocracy were very often educated in Latin. And by the Renaissance, you had Latin schools, and the children learned plenty of Latin in school. They read the little office. The little office is essentially the office of the Blessed Virgin, which is the same every day. So you don't have the difficult task of singing or saying the 150 psalms in the course of the week, but you have the few psalms which repeat, and so you can become really familiar with those. It is possible to sing the Little Office. It uses all of the same antiphons as the Office of the Blessed Virgin, and I, in fact, put together a little booklet for us to use, and we have sometimes sung the Little Office. Some of my singers began to sing the Little Office by themselves just on particular occasions, and I've really encouraged them. So the sung office, then, is something beautiful, is something prayerful, is something that is a part of our tradition. Some people quote St. Augustine, who said, qui bene cantat bis orat, who sings well, prays twice. In fact, Father Zulstorff, who did his dissertation on Augustine, reports on his website that someone has surveyed the works of Augustine, and it is not to be found in any extant work of St. Augustine. But what is to be found is just as good. He who sings praise does not only praise, but also praises joyfully. He who sings praise not only sings, but loves him who is singing about or to or for. So that's just as good, perhaps even better. Augustine also said, cantare amantis est, singing belongs to the one who loves. So if you say, qui bene cantat bis orat, you are summarizing what Augustine actually did say. So when you sing, then, be assured that when you sing well, and I have to say, this is a bit of a circular argument, what is singing well? Well, singing well is praying while you're singing. When you sing praise, it is a worthy praise. And I recommend to you, as you can, to look into the singing of some of the hours of the office, either regularly or on special occasions. Thanks. I must commend you on your attention. I was worried if we're going to have dinner and we're going to have talks, it's going to be hard to talk over dinner. And it is not the case. I'm just delighted to see you listening so closely and so attentively. So my thanks to you.